I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world. Are you serious?
He's defended Black Panthers, Hell's Angels, and members of the Aryan Brotherhood, but he will soon discover that the Are You Serious show is utterly indefensible. Legendary radical lawyer Tony Serra will be with us soon. But first, the Are You Serious show is now accepting audio comments. Go to areyouseriousradio.com and tell us what you think or ask us about anything. And we will play some comments on some future shows and probably even respond to them. Also, fear not, Diana Brown will be back with us soon. And today we have Jeff Deal and the marvelous Destiny, who will be keeping it surreal for us today. And so it was another one of those big do-gooder rock festivals this weekend organized by Al Gore as part of his campaign to raise awareness about global warming. And there they were, Smashing Pumpkins, Kanye West, Duran Duran, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Spinal Tap, and of course in Shanghai, Captain Jive-Ass and the Motherfuckers. So what do we think? It's easy to be cynical about these things and fun. I try not to be too cynical, and at the same time, I couldn't bring myself to really pay attention even to the fact that this was happening.
Yeah, I tried.
Until the day it was happening.
Exactly.
It just seemed like the wrong note at the wrong time, all other politics aside.
I tried watching it last night, and it just didn't seem to have the same urgency, the same drama. The first time you do one of these things, you're like, oh my gosh, a global concert with all these big stars. The second time you do it, like, oh wow, they're doing it again. You do it again 20 years later. I remember this back in the 80s. What's the big deal this time?
Right.
Well, I don't know. Somebody thinks it's a big deal, though, because the headline on Google reads that Live Earth inspires thousands to go green.
There
thousands?
You go. Well worth the expense. I think Roger Daltrey of The Who said it pretty well. The world doesn't need another big rock festival. I mean, it just seems like they had a tin ear for the zeitgeist, if nothing else. So a lot of people were just pretty negative about it. Although, I mean, I guess it did turn people on in Shanghai, China, and maybe that will lead to something. Because China is, you know, that's a big problem.
So maybe the people in China will elect different leaders who take global warming more seriously?
Well, obviously they're not going to be able to do that, but maybe it'll create some kind of a movement there. You never know.
Well, it looks like the numbers are that 2 billion watched, but I guess it sounds like maybe they were all in China.
They might all have been. Well, they said 2 billion were going to watch, so I don't know if I would trust those numbers. I watched it. I missed Spinal Tap.
Well, it says estimated, but it does say that an estimated 2 billion people around the world watched. But I don't know how they count those.
But see, the real question is what happens next. And I'll say this. When I tuned in, the person who was singing was Kelly Clarkson. And I'm like, wait, that from American Idol, right? Which I don't watch, but I understand everyone in their 20s watches that show quite a bit. So maybe that's the real problem, is that they had a lot of acts that were really trying to bring in the next generation, the young people, the uncynical high school and college students who really will take over and inherit the planet and make a difference next time. So maybe the fact that it didn't impress me is sort of beside the point. Maybe it impressed somebody.
That could be true, because I actually enjoyed watching Roger Waters, so that shows, you know, I'm an old fogey, and I thought he was actually rather cynical, not verbally, but in the songs that he chose. So he sort of made an interesting point of contrast with
what songs did he choose?
Well, We Don't Need No Education. It's just sort of the way he, did it, and you know, you could see he was taking a certain glee and. Anti-bureaucratic.
Is this really a cause that needs to be that the people need to be educated on, though? You know, it's like, global warming. I don't think that there's a young person out there that doesn't, think that global warming is a problem.
Well, maybe it meant something in other parts of the world.
It might also be more of a symbolic thing culturally to demonstrate to like the big companies that everybody on the planet does take this seriously or something? I don't know.
Well, see, you asked if we need this. I mean, do we have global warming legislation in place right now that will address all the global warming issues that we have? And I'd say the answer to that is probably no. And so we need something.
Yeah, but how does this lead to legislation?
I don't know.
They did have suggestions for different things to do to conserve energy, you know.
Yeah, actually, that's true. Somebody actually said on the show, you know, you should vote with your pocketbooks. So maybe their goal really wasn't new legislation. Maybe their goal was to actually get the free market to address this by saying there's a consumer demand for green products and choices.
One of the interesting moments on the show actually was, believe it or not, and I'm no great admirer of Sting, but Sting's wife was on there talking about what Chevron was doing in Ecuador. I thought that was, I mean, quite intense. About how they're, you know, repressing millions of people down there and utterly toxifying.
See, now that's interesting. If you look at it as a caucus, almost, you know, like here's just an excuse for prominent people on the planet to vote. Basically, they're basically saying, I vote yay that this issue needs to be addressed or something.
I, Kevin Bacon, also vote. I mean, he was there.
Yeah, Kevin. I just think, I don't know, I mean, in the long run, or not really in the long run, but what am I trying to say? In the short run, rock and roll shouldn't be so righteous all the time. I think they need to put together another festival, and I don't give a fuck about anything festival where
except people, for rock and roll.
Where people get to just, you know, get loose.
And they all show up and say, I also don't give a fuck about everything. They all show up and wait.
Well, there are plenty of those, believe me. There's lots of rock festivals that happen every year, and of course.
That's true. There is the Ozfest. Did anybody catch Spinal Tap? That was my one regret. I didn't. I tuned in at the wrong time and I didn't get to catch Tap.
I just heard people being interviewed on the radio and they said, are you going to watch? And they said, hell yeah, I want to see Spinal Tap. So, you know, forget about Kelly Clarkson and Duran Duran and all those people. Spinal Tap, wow.
They want to see the real fake band.
That's the take-home message. I think this is the Tap reunion.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
The last time I tried to book Tony Serra, I found out he was in the slammer for not paying his taxes. But now he's out, and he's here with us. And he's brought us all the money that he meant to send to the IRS but forgot. And, wow, look at the size of that bag of money. Let's go. Welcome, Tony.
Hi. I'm happy to be here. The fact of the matter is I was convicted of willful failure to pay.
Willful.
And there, a misdemeanor, not moral turpitude, so I'm still actively practicing after a 10-month hiatus. But the point was, no, I had no money to give them, and there's no surplus at this point to give anyway.
That's kind of the point when you don't pay your taxes frequently. I mean, it's sort of like you started off, it sounded like a tax resistor, and then there's also just the idea I can't be bothered. And Thoreau did that, actually.
I wonder. You know, I've read what he had to say. You remember he was in for not paying taxes.
That's when he wrote Civil Disobedience.
I don't know. He was only in for like 24 hours,
right.
Or 36 hours. But Emerson comes and says, like, what are you doing in there? And he says to Emerson, what are you doing out there? Uh-huh. Remember that?
Yeah.
But there's a variety of components from my tax perspective, and one we will call, as was ultimately recorded in the litigation, is that I'm financially dysfunctional. But that stems from a principled stance with regard to taxation, from my perspective.
Now, you're part of your financial dysfunction from a piece I read, I think, by Burr Snyder, who a fine fellow who I've also been covered by. You took some acid at some point and decided that you were not interested in having a very close relationship with money.
Well, there's a number of truths that you've expressed, some dormant and, you know, some more manifest. I, like many of my ilk, probably looking at you yourself, but you're much younger, took a lot of acid, you know, on a relative scale, let's say between 64 and 80 or 78 or something like that.
Right.
And a number of the things become, from my perspective, more focused. And obviously one of those included in a political dimension an attitude toward taxation. But you're referring to that Bert Schneider said that I took an informal vow of poverty, which is also true. Whether or not the informal vow of poverty was a component in the political perspective of taxation is probably questionable. Whether it's a component, however, in ultimate financial dysfunction, probably.
Well, I mean, there's a particular kind of anality that's enforced by the tax system in the sense that you have to not only keep track of every piece of your income, which is hard if you're a freelancer, but you have to keep track of all the different expenses and all that. And you know,
well, it wasn't mere lethargy, but yes, I'm not an accountant, and I'm not going
but
to...
But you are a lawyer, so you're good at organizing stuff on some level.
No,
intuitively.
I'm an aberrated lawyer. Right. I'm good at winning jury trials. I've been good at winning jury trials for 44 years, and that's a very small slice of the pie. The rest of it I deny, I reject, and I defy.
Well, you say, I mean, you're a good lawyer, not because you're, like, really good at tightly organizing information, but more like an intuitive, passionate thing? Or is it both?
Less intuitive and a passionate would be a word I would be, you know, thrilled to have applied.
Yeah.
So how long ago was this that you reached this decision that
Dare I say three convictions ago, three tax convictions? No, at an early stage, I was a philosophy major at Stanford and was not, going to be involved, let's call it, in fighting establishment as a career. I hoped, but, you know, it's all past tense that somehow I could write bad poetry and, you know, die anonymously in some foreign country and be discovered, you know, 20 years after death, like the romantic fallacy that provides incentive, I think, for all bad poets. And so I went off to Morocco and got involved with a number of people who were shooting heroin and et cetera. And I was like a Joe Palooka. I played baseball and football and boxed at Stanford. And it was an unwholesome, for me at that point, life experience. So I think I just wrote to Bolt. I applied by mail. And I wanted to be a mafia lawyer, but again, a romantic fallacy. And then I went to Bolt, UC Berkeley. I did very well in terms of grades and thank God the Haight-Ashbury then started.
Right.
That, you know, introduced me at an early stage to an alternate culture, to let's call it political awareness, certainly to drugs and music and a lot of Eastern lifestyles. Eastern meaning kind of out of Buddhism or you know, some kind of Southeast Asian perspective rather than traditional Christianity with a small C that I you know, experience as an American growing up in San Francisco.
So, I mean, when you started off, you really started off defending a lot of drug cases, a lot of hippie type.
Well, yes, this was an era of communes in San Francisco, and they would be raided for drugs, and drugs were omnipresent, and I was... I was a dance for. I used kind of my athletic, I don't know what you call it, inclination, and made a transfer into being a dance freak. So I was at all of the early forums, you know, till 2 or 3 in the morning, just full of sweat and getting up at 6 in the morning and going to court all day. It was like a fabulous lifestyle. So I became like part of the scene. And they, in the early days, they would say, oh, do you want the public defender? No, I want Tony Sarah. And I would go from, you know, one bus to the next, sometimes representing 20 people at a time. And it was very fruitful. I had, you know, I immediately had more jury trials than anyone of my, you know, age level at that time. Right. So I became very experienced. I became political. I became kind of the, you know, ultimately the black Black Panther lawyer when Huey returned from Cuba. And I worked with the SLA, and I worked with the Black Panthers. I worked with the White Panthers. I worked with the New World Liberation Front. I work with the communes in San Francisco, most notably the Good Earth communes. Later, that transferred into prison groups, represented persons, high ups in many instances of most prison groups. That transferred into Hell's Angels, a number of bike clubs, things like that. So with regard to what I'll call groups and maybe law enforcement calls organized crime on occasion, I probably have participated in most of them. Right. And this ultimately becomes the large smuggling groups and the large distribution groups that have been prosecuted federally for the past 20 years, mostly in San Francisco and in Oakland. However, in the same time frame, I kind of, because I was a good trial lawyer, I took my show on the road, so to speak. So at this juncture, I've qualified in about 44 different jurisdictions. So I've tried cases in the East and the South, in the West, and, Hawaii. I mean, many different federal and state jurisdictions through the United States. That kind of distinguishes me because most trial lawyers, I don't know, I'm saying most, 95% will stay within a locality, and that locality can be large, like the West or the East or the South. And I have had
you're sort of known on the gotten known on the circuit that you find William Kunstler and you don't find William Kunstler anyway.
But they used to
anymore.
Call me when I had hair and I wasn't gray and bald, Kunstler West. So I was very prideful. But then he took a number of cases that I wouldn't have taken. And you know how you get kind of critical.
It's curious because when I see the cases you've taken, obviously you take a lot of cases. Not all kinds of people that you would necessarily be sympathetic with their politics. I've seen Aryan Brotherhood and Hell's Angels and mafia people.
Yeah.
So you take
mafia. I've done Aryan Brotherhood.
So how would you find? What were the ones that Kunstler took that you wouldn't have taken, and how do you make those kinds of decisions?
Well, let me first answer the first issue. I take cases that I, in my relativistic viewpoint, see a merit in it. But then I define merit in a number of ways. So why Hell's Angel cases are important and Aryan Brotherhood cases are important? Because it has normally, the investigation has brought out the worst of the law enforcement, informants and their, violation of, call it, Fourth Amendment are the most flagrant because for them, the end justifies the means. And these people, from their perspective, are bad people. And so they twist and deform, from my perspective, their procedures, the due processes, certainly the use of informants. I can remember one major Hell's Angels case, probably many people remember, it was first RICO case where they were all acquitted of the RICO count. One trial took about 9 months and one trial took about 6 months, multiple defendants. But they actually gave one of the informants a complete immunity and he admitted something like 7 murders and 7 heinous murders. I mean, really like bad murders, not self-defense issues or, provocations. These were assassinations. And
let the guy off who
let
had
him
done
off for
the,
7
assassinations.
One, another guy, they gave $30,000 cash in a suitcase as a payment in the large Hells Angel cases. Two of the snitches, rather than go the last 9 yards, or what do they call it,
I don't know how many yards are involved.
Yes, last 10 yards. They identified me as the culprit. Ask you, do you see anyone in the court? And they were going sideways on the government.
They went after you?
No, they identified me rather than identify the person that they had testified before in the grand jury because they feared ultimate repercussions.
Right.
But getting back to the issue, you take cases where you don't necessarily agree with the philosophy or the sociology of the client, where the government has overstepped. What I've done all my life is I fought the government. I cross-examine, you know, lying police officers, perjurious snitches, you know, informants that have been given rewards, informants who have gone free, informants who have perpetrated crime greater than that with which, you know, they point the finger to. So those are lush with those kind of issues without, you know, identifying with ideology. So, you know, that's the short answer.
I get it. So you're going after abuse, basically, in the judicial system and dealing with
civil liberties. Yes, where it's governmental abuse, governmental inequity, governmental harassment, governmental political charged cases, government corruption. I mean, all of those old platitudes are present. Right. Governmental racism.
Right. I mean, like, let's say you've had a lot of murder cases. Do you feel more passionate if you know the person is not guilty, or is the main thing the fact that the government has abused their...
Well, once I said, what did I say? God, they threw it back at me for years. Like, my nutriment or some, my nourishment is drugs and murder or something.
Right.
Murder's another issue. Here's just I've done an awful lot of murder. I do back-to-back murder. I do three murder trials, at least three murder trials a year, you know, amongst many others. Murder trials take a long time. I just finished 7 weeks on a double homicide attempted murder, started as death penalty, ended up LWOP in Martinez. So I do a lot of murder, and I justify murder not ideologically. I justify murder, I think, you know, from my perspective, because of the drama. I'm drawn at this stage to the drama. You know, you pick up, if they have it, a murder weapon, you hold it up there, you know, and you start examining, and there's just a hushness. You know, there's like the proverbial pin drop would be a crash of sound.
Sure.
And it your heart is pounding half the time. You know, you're crying. The prosecutors are the best. From my perspective, and I've done every kind of case, practically, I don't do sexual misconduct, child molest, rape, any of that.
Right.
So other than that type of case, I've done everything. I've done this 44 years, and I do it back-to-back jury trials. The best prosecutors are the senior homicide prosecutors, the death penalty prosecutors. Well, what does best mean? Best means sometimes dirty, lying, cheating, you know, but highly adversarial and highly confrontational and highly, they're always very prepared. And they're very extroverted, and they carry with them the, you know, the self-righteous indignation, because normally the crime is one of little justification and lots of horror. So I guess what I'm saying is that I got hooked. I always say for me the practice law is like a drug. It's like a narcotic.
Right.
And the murder trial is the heroin, you know, of litigation. It completely absorbs me. It completely, you know, envelops me. I always say you shoot the person up. It's you take this personality. You take this, you know, could be sociopathic or obsessive or psychiatrically, you know, flawed, and you take them and you absorb him and you become, you know, greater than he, because you absorb all of the emotions and the passions, but then you're adding to it a dimension of verbal articulation that he or the whole dimension doesn't have. So in essence, you know, the metaphor I always use is you're taking this kind of raw clay, this kind of, you know, vulgar dirt, and you are making a vase. You have to sell it. You make it something perfect, beautiful. You make it something wholesome. You make it something moral. And the challenge is very, very great. The drama is high. It instills, you can see as I'm talking, it instills in you a metabolic rush. I think it's equivalent equivalent, you know, to snorting cocaine. It's something that I've been drawn to, not the snorting of cocaine, but I think
you don't need to.
The same analogy, because you're hyped and you're sleepless, sure, and you're fervent and you're animated and, you know, you're passionate and that touches a zone in your mind. That
I'm
makes
so glad.
You articulate.
I'm really glad you got into this, because that's sort of what I intuited, that there was this
but
great intrigue.
That isn't the
and,
political tone, Sarah. Right. That's like, you know, Tony
interesting
Sarah,
challenge
the aesthete or something. You know, you're doing it for the rush.
But so how exactly do you do that? You stand up, you got that rush going, you're in front of the jury, and then what kind of decisions do you have to make along the way that makes it go your way instead of the other way?
I understand that a good trial lawyer is a consummate performer. So obviously you suppress the metabolism, and when you're called upon to be quiet and to be kind of passive or to manifest, you know, the pathos or to try to induce, you know, the compassion, you're using one intonation and one vocabulary. When you're raging at maybe a lying witness because of murder, they lie or they color their testimony, then you know you use your passion and you approach a rage, and you can use, you know, call it metaphors of the street. And always, though, you throw it out, and you throw it out far. What am I talking about? Acting out emotional verbiage. You throw it out far, but in the net you pull back. And you're the next witness, maybe the so-called sweet old lady that you can't say, oh, yes, oh, I quite understand. Oh, but did you see that? You didn't look that way? Well, then, of course, you wouldn't have seen it. Now. Something, you know, you have to play a different kind of role with each witness. And, of course, you know, in the rage, you never lose your rationality. In the manifestation of the pain and the suffering and the desire for jury empathy, you never lose yourself. And as soon as you lose yourself, you're lost. So in a way, you're a spontaneous, consummate, performer, dramatist. But it's real. It's not like it's rehearsed. The beauty of trial work is the spontaneity. You're called upon, you know, sometimes by... Just to give another metaphor, an issue arises, and in trial, the issue arises like a bolt of lightning, you know, flashing in the sky. You have to respond immediately at the same level. And so you have only the time that it takes to rise to your feet. I never do anything from a seated capacity. When they, like, if you go into court and you see lawyers, sometimes they're sitting down when they examine. I've never done that in my life. That's like, you know, that lawyer isn't a lawyer. So I rise anytime I'm going to say something. Sometimes in that fraction of a second, you have to create profundity, imagination, poetry. You know, you have to thunder, you have to lightning, you have to explode, or you have to, you know, be shocked. It's there. You have it. It's part of the inventory of responses that you can draw on. But the drawing on it is an act of spontaneity, and that's a challenge, and that's why it's like being high or whatever word you want to use.
Has anybody ever put you speaking to music, done an audio collage?
I had for a short time in my life, and I'm so bad on names, but Native American. What's
Trudell, John Trudell?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I, you know, love what he did.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And yes, in the next life, that's what I wanted to do, but not in this life.
I think we got to get a beat behind us.
Here's what I always say. This is a sadness. All of us, you know, when we're post-adolescent, we're exposed, hopefully, to beautiful language, to poetry and literature, and, you know, all forms, let's just say, of sensitive semantics.
Yeah.
What happens to a criminal defense trial lawyer is you lose first your feelings and your sensitivity toward love or romance or beauty, you know, exotica. You lose the sensitivity because you're a warrior. Next, after losing the sensitivity, you lose the vocabulary. It becomes embedded in the adolescent passive vocabulary you carry with you at some domain, but within the recesses of your memory, but you don't have it at your fingertip, at your lip, you know, service. It's hard to pull out. And so I always say, I have no words for romance. I have no words for love. I have no, you know, words for honor and dignity and passion and travel and, you know, religion. I am a semantic warrior. My words are my weapons. And so you become very narrowly confined. You become very abbreviated as a total human being. And ultimately, when you allow various avenues of stimulation to come in from the aesthetic zone, from the romantic zone, from the love zone, from the travel zone, when you allow a few of them to come in, it's very upsetting. Because you know how you've crystallized, how you've become, you know, dogmatic, how you've become narrow-minded,
become
how
a weapon,
become tunnel vision, you know, like, and why, you know, like, I was going to ripen as a flower, why did I become this cactus? You know, you're ultimately thinking that you're all shrunken with stickers, you know, protruding in every direction. Those are verbal stickers.
Well, it sounds to me like you're writing contemporary Shakespeare right here. And I think we hardly even need to hear any rock and roll.
I haven't smoked a joint, my friend.
You know, hardly even need any rock and roll with Tony Serra in the room. But nevertheless, we're going to break for a few minutes and hear some music and be right back with Tony Serra. Back with Tony Serra. I mean, you basically do the lawyering of the street, but do you follow the sort of high level, like, let's get the government stuff from Watergate to now? And do you have any thoughts on, like, the whole Scooter Libby thing and that kind of stuff?
Let me say that in the past, I read 2 newspapers a day, you know, like New York Times and Chronicle,
right.
But also 2 legal publications that go to most lawyers. And I think most of the time I would watch the 6 o'clock news, and therefore I stayed abreast.
Right.
Presently, and I don't know if it's an act of attrition or purposeful commitment. I'm not doing that because it seems like the themes are so repetitive. What we're talking about, the themes, is like what the Republicans are doing, what Bush is doing, and
right.
what's happening in Iraq, and what's happening with respect to oil, and what's happening in Afghanistan, and what the alleged terrorism is made of. It became too repetitious, or maybe going away 10 months wasn't available to me.
Right.
And maybe, everything is subject to psychiatric review here. Maybe it released for me a level of pain and suffering. The news isn't good out there. The image of the United States is as low as it's ever been. We're killing people. We're back, into this imperialism. It's so bad. The fact that it was curtailed while I was incarcerated, it was like a mixed blessing, and I'm trying to perpetuate that. So the answer to your question, yes, once I used to be on top of things, so to speak. But now less so.
But you don't get into a sort of a feeling like you'd like to be part of taking down Cheney or something like that. Legally, not with a rope or,
Well, I can't manifest all the thoughts that I have about what they used to call direct actions in the 60s.
Right.
But, of course, I think all thinking people who watch, I guess, what's occurring, have moments of delirium where they place themselves, I guess, at the center of some meaningful direct actions.
Right.
I think, that it some of it's surreal, some of it's dreamlike, some of it's cogent, some of it's valid, some of it's just loose thought, but sure. But I have no tonic. I have no, cure for what's occurring. I think it's pretty bad out there. The Supreme Court's pact of judges have lost the, equality in terms of balance of power. The executive is swollen. It's burgeoned with power. There's never been more, spying and more informants and more government intrusion into personal liberties
now,
and
do you
privacy.
Do you think it's worse than what was going on with COINTELPRO and that was pretty intense.
I lived that. It was domestic.
Yeah.
It targeted freedom-seeking groups, and that's bad,
sure.
And that retards, let's call it ultimately, a free society. I guess you can say it co-extended with Vietnam War and therefore has some analogy with respect to us being in Iran and Iraq.
Right.
But maybe I'm more sensitive now because that was the 60s.
Right.
When those things surfaced in the 60s, maybe I'm just romantically talking about my youth and you add an afterglow to your youth. But I was in Berkeley.
Right.
There was demonstrations and there was protests and there was anger and there was, resistance and there was fiery speeches and, things were occurring. That was one of the vortexes of resistance, of reform. Now we're sheep, man. How we do not protest the gasoline rise. in the 60s, and I'm not suggesting this, I'm a pacifist, but in the 60s they would have bombed the goddamn gas stations, not intending to hurt anyone. You know, but at 12 o'clock at night, Standard Oil would have gotten it, Shell would have gotten it. What an outrage. No one feels the outrage that they are, one, you know, making more money than they made in the history of the world, of anyone made billions and billions of dollars, and they're still, you know, it's going up, up. No one can stop this. It's capitalistic cannibalism. No one cares. We just line up like sheep, and no one demonstrate protest, no boycott, no nothing. So that's one. But the underside of that, go and get the oil. This is, you know, the world power image. Bring our youth, our soldiers into Iraq. Kill everyone. Destroy the country. Destroy Afghanistan. Destroy Iran next. Get Syria. You know, level it all so we can rebuild it with their oil and take, you know, their wealth. Like, and no one protests a little, the distinction between the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, in my mind, two heads on the same serpent. It blows me away that we are so passive about it, so accepting. We succumb to the power. You know, the capitalism has prevailed. Imperialism, you know, is with well and strong. American brutality, American murder and homicide abroad is accepted. Everything in the media that is spun from government is full of lies and deceit. And where are the Mario Savios? I don't know. You know, who even says boycott? So no, for me, the 60s, at least there was resistance. There was, you know, actions taken. Youth was alert. Youth was, you know, sensitive. Now we sit, you know, we're couch potatoes. We're overfed. Our minds are sullen and slow, and we do nothing, and we watch it and just maybe, oh, hope that a new president might do turn it all about. No, so it's far worse now. And then we had an act of vital Fourth Amendment. Judges would throw, right, you know, cases out. The Fourth Amendment was sacred. The First Amendment was strong. Now we have nothing. Then the judges were individualistic, and they gave justice, you know, to the person, you know, and to the event. Now we have sentences that are legislated, which, you know, as you know, that they're predetermined. Their sentencing, the judge has little or no discretion.
Right. Talk about being in Lompoc. A lot of people are now who probably would have been in there expecting possibly to get released or something, or just in there for these long extended sentences.
No, one of the saddest things will be in my life is the spectacle of young people, you know, who committed crimes that was maybe like 6 months of their life of 20 years and were put away for 10s and 20s and 30s of years.
Right.
The mandatory sentences are just ripped, you know, part of the fabric of youth from our culture and is putting them into these you know, warehouses where their body is stored and their mind deteriorates. It's a sad...
Like what you were saying about the rest of us, but Lompoc sounds like a really desultory place these days.
Well, I made a metaphor, or borrowed a metaphor. There's various types in prison.
Right.
And, you know, you take the image, for instance, of a bird cage, and
right. There
are canaries who sing. That means there's prisoners who prosper, and they're institutionalized, and their forebearers have been institutionalized, and maybe their expectations are low, and they get along. And that's one. I call that like the canary. Then there's a wild bird. And a wild bird, and if you've ever seen a wild bird in a cage, will beat wings against the cage, you know, against the bars till they die, till they perish. And you see those in prison. They're combative and surly and resistant and activistic. You know, they're just contra, and they die. And the death that they is the death of mind and body. They're put away, you know, 23-hour day locked down. They're in isolation, so the wild birds perish. Then there are the dead birds. that you see them, they're these people, and you look at them and their face, and they're you know, young in a way, but their hair is all old and gray, right. And they've done 20s and 30s, and they're just the corpse of human being, and there's no vitality and no vigor, no life, nothing meaningful. Then there's all kinds. There's the parrots, you know, who do. They're going to wait it out. They're going to be on that perch. They're going to sing the song that's required. They're going to say the right thing. They're going to do the right thing, but they're waiting, and they're waiting 10s and 20s and 30s a year because they will get out. And every, you know, it's a field day for psychiatry, you know, the way the adjustment occurs. But it's ultimately, you know, a path toward death. It's death of mind and death of spirit and death of imagination. It's not, you know, a pleasant thing to see people in custody. And for the most part, they're creative and they're wholesome. Mankind, you know, is not some, we're hiding some kind of, underbelly of filth or underbelly of immorality or insurrection or vice or ugliness. No, these people are good people and... No sentence. No, I don't care if you know you committed murder. No sentence should be more than 10 years. No drug sentence should be more than a year. They have people in there now like superannuated. There's a whole superannuated level of convict now. They're all old and gray. They're over 60. Jesus Christ, what a scene. What a disgusting, you know, comment on our civilization. Death penalty now has never been stronger in this country. We're the most uncivilized, barbaric, you know, civilization. We're just one, you know, heap of materialism in this country.
We seem to be really in love with incarceration at this point. I mean, the idea of punishment is very strong.
Yes, and getting stronger and stronger. Yeah. But this is their answer. But it's not the answer. Well, what did Mao do, Mr. Sarah? What did Fidel do, Mr. Sarah? What happened to Trotsky and Marx's dream in Russia, Mr. Sarah? Like all the other experiments from what we will call communism, which never really was, you know, actualized, to what we'll call socialism, failed. But it failed because we are imperialistic, because we are militaristic, we are aggressive, we are combative, we suppress, we repress. You know, we are the
You're
most vicious,
human beings,
the most vicious, you know, population on the globe, the United States of America. Huh. They call it, they talk about. Oh, the terrorists, you know, sacrificing themselves for their cause and blowing people up. Well, think of our Marines. Our Marines are suicide warriors. They've been suicide warriors, you know, from the beginning. Take that hill. Well, 80% of us will die. Well, we'll honor you. Every warrior culture has suicide warriors. You have to have it. That's one thing. And we have it as much as they have it.
Right. But I mean, all cultures seem to set up these prison systems. I mean, imagine Mao Zedong would have said, without our help, he would have still set up
a prison system. Mao slaughtered millions. Right. Castro slaughtered, I don't know, thousands or hundreds of thousands. Stalin slaughtered millions. Right. So what they say is, we are the compassionate. Right. We are the benign. We merely just put you in jail for the rest of your life. That's not the answer. It's not the same kind of thing. Sure. Those were revolutions. What we have here is, you know, domestic disturbances, sociological contradictions. And for that, they're giving this very punitive kind of sanction.
Would you describe yourself as an anarchist?
I'm not, I haven't read enough about
it. Right.
I know it's the current mentality of those people I respect.
Right.
And therefore, I hope I would qualify, but I haven't read enough. I'm a reader in terms of like identifying with an ideology. You got to read at least six of the major proponents of it before you say I identify or I don't identify. And like most thinking people, You know, I've gone through a number. I was a Platonist. I was an existentialist. Mm-hmm. I was a Marxist. You know, it goes on and on as life goes on.
Well, so after all that, what's your answer? I mean,
Here's what I am, and it's a sad commentary. I seethe with what I'll call negative beliefs. What are some of my negative beliefs? I don't believe in private property, ownership of private property. I don't believe, therefore, in probate, where you give property from one generation to the next. I don't believe in capitalism. I don't believe in corporations. I don't believe in taxation. I don't believe in marriage, where the state, you know, it's a tripartite relationship, and the state is one of the parties. So I see with all these negative. I don't believe in war. I don't believe in oil economy. I don't believe, you know, in the atomic bomb. I don't believe in the death penalty. I don't believe in incarcerating people for more than 10 years. Boggity, boggity, boggity. I don't believe that people have the free will that religion, you know, postulates, and therefore the intentionality in terms of criminality is lacking for the most part. So I see with all these negative beliefs. Do you have a positive belief? What's your utopia? How are you going to get there? And for me, it's just very simplistic. And I decided a long time ago, I don't have to be a deep thinker. I just keep people out of steel cages. That's enough. That's my little contribution. I'm against steel cages for human beings and animals also.
Well, I don't think we need everybody in the world to be prescriptive. You're out there fighting to keep people out of cages.
Must have been weird to be in a cage and seeing all the other people also in cages, people that you used to keep out of cages, and now you're there among them watching them.
Well, that everything is, you know, it's yin yang. Being in custody for a criminal defense lawyer with my type of ideology is like being a doctor locked up in a hospital. You know, everyone has needs, and you're one of the few that can help them. They all have appeals and are hoping for appeals or writs of habeas corpus or some involvement in litigation. Many of it is civil. Much of it, however, is criminal. Everyone wants to talk to you. I had my license for at least part. They suspended me for a while, but I had my license so I could speak to them, pretend like a father before my license was restored. And like a lawyer, after, I had lines of people. I did all kinds of good work while I was in there. I helped write writs and appeals. I did civil stuff, which I don't do, but I'm capable. I did divorces. I wrote letters to collection companies. I mediated debt disputes, blah, 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 blah. So there's a terrific need. And that's what I do. That's what I am. And so to be there in that sense was a calling, a challenge, something that fit conveniently into my ideology. So it was beautiful in that sense. Obviously, you know, you miss your loved ones, you miss your freedom, I miss jury trials, I miss my lady. I mean, those are all natural things, and when you balance it out, absolutely not. I'm a free man, I'm a bird, I'm not a canary, and therefore, you know, I negate, I will fight against all my life. You know, one of the first things I did when I got out, I brought a civil action, a class suit against the prison system for not paying minimum wage. They have all of these people in there. That's why they have you know, these prison camps. There's probably over 50 of them in the country because it's free labor. These people, like I was paid 19 cents an hour, and others are paid 6 cents an hour, and others are paid maybe $1.43 an hour. They work their goddamn ass off, and the prison system makes millions on them. The prison industries claims it makes $65 million a year off the backs of the prisoner labor, but that's bullshit. They make far more than that because they subtract all of the wages of the guards, which they're supposed to be paying anyway. So the guards are pertinent to the camp system and to the prison industries. So that was one of the first things I did when I got out, and you know, I continue to do what I can. I'm not a post-conviction specialist. So, you know, I don't do appeals and I don't do habeas corpus. I did while I was in. I learned. My mind my mind's alert. But on the outside, I'm more valuable, I think, as a jury trial specialist. I'm one person who's done it 44 years. There's very few who do it actively and meaningfully for 44 years. Cats my age normally are retired, or they'll take, you know, $1 million case here, and they'll be on their yacht for the, you know, 9 months a year. I'm still in the trenches and very active and very, you can see from just the way I speak, very committed, loyal, passionate about fighting the system.
Well, and very much alive, and I want to thank you for coming in, man. There are so many other things I'd love to ask you about, but I think we're running out of time. I hope you'll come back.
Sure, my pleasure.
Incredible. Yeah. All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Love's the only weapon.
Shit! Are you serious?